Penguin Random House Audio presents Warlight by Michael Ndaatje, read for you by Steve West. For Ellen Seligman, Sonny Mater, and Liz Calder, over the years. Most of the great battles are fought in the creases of topographical maps. Part 1. A Table Full of Strangers. In 1945, our parents went away and left us in the care of two men who may have been criminals. We were living on a street in London called Ruvigny Gardens, and one morning, either our mother or our father suggested that after breakfast the family have a talk, and they told us that they would be leaving us and going to Singapore for a year. Not too long, they said, but it would not be a brief trip either. We would, of course, be well cared for in their absence. I remember our father was sitting on one of those uncomfortable iron garden chairs as he broke the news, while our mother, in a summer dress just behind his shoulder, watched how we responded. After a while, she took my sister Rachel's hand and held it against her waist, as if she could give it warmth. Neither Rachel nor I said a word. We stared at our father, who was expanding on the details of their flight on the new Avro Tudor 1, a descendant of the Lancaster bomber, which could cruise at more than 300 miles an hour. They would have to land and change planes at least twice before arriving at their destination. He explained he had been promoted to take over the Unilever office in Asia, a step up in his career. It would be good for us all. He spoke seriously, and our mother turned away at some point to look at her August garden. After my father had finished talking, seeing that I was confused, she came over to me and ran her fingers like a comb through my hair. I was 14 at the time, and Rachel nearly 16, and they told us we would be looked after in the holidays by a guardian, as our mother called him. They referred to him as a colleague. We had already met him. We used to call him the Moth, a name we had invented. Ours was a family with a habit for nicknames, which meant it was also a family of disguises. Rachel had already told me she suspected he worked as a criminal. The arrangement appeared strange, but life still was haphazard and confusing during that period after the war, so what had been suggested did not feel unusual. We accepted the decision, as children do, and the Moth, who had recently become our third-floor lodger, a humble man, large but moth-like in his shy movements, was to be the solution. Our parents must have assumed he was reliable. As to whether the Moth's criminality was evident to them, we were not sure. I suppose there had once been an attempt to make us a tightly knit family. Now and then, my father let me accompany him to the Unilever offices, which were deserted during weekends and bank holidays. And while he was busy, I'd wander through what seemed an abandoned world on the 12th floor of the building. I discovered all the office drawers were locked. There was nothing in the waste paper baskets, no pictures on the walls, although one wall in his office held a large relief map depicting the company's foreign locations. Mombasa, the Cocos Islands, Indonesia, and nearer to home, Trieste, Heliopolis, Benghazi, Alexandria, cities that cordoned off the Mediterranean, locations I assumed were under my father's authority. Here was where they booked holds on the hundreds of ships that traveled back and forth to the east. The lights on the map that identified those cities and ports were unlit during the weekends, in darkness, much like those far outposts. At the last moment, it was decided our mother would remain behind for the final weeks of the summer, to oversee the arrangements for the lodger's care over us and ready us for our new boarding schools. On the Saturday before he flew alone towards that distant world, I accompanied my father once more to the office near Curzon Street. He had suggested a long walk, since, he said, for the next few days his body would be humbled on a plane. So we caught a bus to the Natural History Museum, then walked up through Hyde Park into Mayfair. He was unusually eager and cheerful, singing the lines, "Homespun collars, homespun hearts, wear to rags in foreign parts," repeating them again and again, almost jauntily, as if this was an essential rule. What did it mean? I wondered. I remember we needed several keys to get into the building where the office he worked in took up that whole top floor. I stood in front of the large map, still unlit, memorizing the cities that he would fly over during the next few nights. Even then, I loved maps. He came up behind me and switched on the lights so the mountains on the relief map cast shadows. Though now it was not the lights I noticed so much as the harbors lit up in pale blue, as well as the great stretches of unlit earth. It was no longer a fully revealed perspective, and I suspect that Rachel and I must have watched our parents' marriage with a similar flawed awareness. They had rarely spoken to us about their lives. We were used to partial stories. Our father had been involved in the last stages of the earlier war, and I don't think he felt he really belonged to us. As for their departure, it was accepted that she had to go with him. There was no way, we thought, that she could exist apart from him. She was his wife. There would be less calamity, less collapse of the family, if we were left behind as opposed to her remaining in Ruvigny Gardens to look after us. And, as they explained, we could not suddenly leave the schools into which we had been admitted with so much difficulty. Before his departure, we all embraced our father in a huddle, the moth having tactfully disappeared for the weekend. So we began a new life. I did not quite believe it then, and I am still uncertain whether the period that followed disfigured or energized my life. I was to lose the pattern and restraint of family habits during that time, and, as a result, later on, there would be a hesitancy in me, as if I had too quickly exhausted my freedoms. In any case, I am now at an age where I can talk about it, of how we grew up protected by the arms of strangers. And it is like clarifying a fable about our parents, about Rachel and myself, and the moth, as well as the others who joined us later. I suppose there are traditions and tropes in stories like this. Someone is given a test to carry out. No one knows who the truth bearer is. People are not who or where we think they are. And there is someone who watches from an unknown location. I remember how my mother loved to speak of those ambivalent tasks given to loyal knights in Arthurian legends, and how she told those stories to us, sometimes setting them in a specific small village in the Balkans or in Italy, which she claimed she had been to and found for us on a map. With the departure of our father, our mother's presence grew larger. The conversations we used to overhear between our parents had always been about adult matters. But now she began telling us stories about herself, about growing up in the Suffolk countryside. We especially loved the tale about the family on the roof. Our grandparents had lived in an area of Suffolk called the Saints, where there was little to disturb them, just the sound of the river, or now and then a church bell from a nearby village. But one month, a family lived on their roof, throwing things around and yelling to one another, so loudly that the noises percolated down through the ceiling and into her family's life. There was a bearded man and his three sons. The youngest was the quiet one. Mostly he carried the pails of water up the ladder to the ones on the roof. But whenever my mother walked from the house to collect eggs from the henhouse or get into the car, she saw him watching them. They were thatchers, fixing the roof, busy all day. At dinner time, they pulled down their ladders and left. But then one day, a powerful wind lifted the youngest son, so he was tilted off balance and fell from the roof, crashing down through the lime bower to land on paving stones by the kitchen. His brothers carried him into the house. The boy, named Marsh, had broken his hip, and the doctor who came sealed his leg in plaster and told them he could not be moved. He would need to stay on a daybed in the
sample complete. Ready to continue?